Now, the United States has described the insurgents in Iraq variously as terrorists, as foreigners, or as loyalists to the regime of Saddam Hussein. And I want to ask you first, what's wrong with that characterization?
Well, I think essentially what you have in Iraq is a popular resistance in large parts of the country, including some of the South. And in order to try and create a media image which can create the impression that this is a handful of people, it's a tiny minority who have nothing to do with Iraq, the United States and allied propaganda operations have come up with this notion that it's a tiny group of people. The amount of publicity given to Zarqawi, this Al-Qaeda guy from Jordan, is beyond belief. If you were to read the U.S. press and the occasionally chunks of the British press, you would get the feeling that there's nothing else going on in Iraq. But in reality, of course, it is a popular resistance. And even now, I mean, this resistance is very strong. It's now impossible for the United States to deny that it's strong. They admit it. And they call it all sorts of names, but that's what it's been like.
Mm-hmm. Can you say anything about the sort of tactics or the ways that the insurgents, the armed fighters, interact with the population from what you've been able to observe?
Well, look, the fact is, what is interesting is that the most of the resistance have got mass support. And if they didn't have, the United States would have been able to find them ages ago. And people would have told them where they were hiding, what they were doing. But very little of this has happened, which indicates clearly that it's a popular resistance. And the tactics of the resistance have been very clear. They have been, A, to take on foreign occupying armies, armies that have occupied their country. And secondly, to target the multinational corporations which are coming to steal their country. This is the first resistance which has targeted both military and economic occupiers. And from that point of view, it's very important.
Another target of the resistance has been those Iraqis who have taken, who have become involved with the police or security systems.
This is absolutely true. And this is somewhere where they, I think a big debate goes on who to target and who not to target. The Iraqi resistance says that it is targeting all collaborators with the occupying regime. And I think, you know, one, we live in a world with short memories, but it is worth recalling that collaborators were targeted when Europe was occupied. They were targeted in Algeria, they were targeted in Vietnam, when the Vietnamese were resisting the United States there. Unfortunately, this is, you know, part of the picture. Once you have a country occupied by foreign troops, people who collaborate with it become part of the problem. So for the resistance, they can't, they target everyone.
And of course, for the occupying forces, building an Iraqi security structure is one of their top priorities.
It is, because they want to reduce Western casualties. They feel that basically this should become a war in which Iraqi kills Iraqi. And so they're creating a structure where basically they hope that ultimately all the fighting will be done by Iraqis. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think if the foreign armies withdrew, you would probably have some conflict, but there would also be moves, political moves made to try and form a national government.
Now, to prepare for this and sort of educate myself on the subject a little bit, I was checking out the web pages for different sort of segments or groups of the resistance or the insurgency, and one of the papers that they referred to quite often was a recent publication by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, authored by Anthony Cordesman,
mm-hmm.
It's called The Developing Iraqi Insurgency Status at End 2004. And, you know, his point, well, one of his points is that the what he calls the insurgency is much bigger than what the U.S. has admitted so far. And he sort of goes into it. Now, his interests are developing an analysis that will help the United States and other allied powers to better control the situation, you know, for their benefit. But he does go into some detail what he sees as the main features of the what he calls the insurgency. And one thing that's really striking about his analysis is that it's very focused on sort of the ethnic or national divisions in the country. So he'll talk about the Sunni insurgency, the Shia resistance, the Kurdish, you know, the other minorities. I'm wondering, you know, what do you think about an analysis that really focuses on those divisions in Iraqi society?
Well, I think these divisions do exist, but I think it is extremely narrow to view the to focus them purely as Sunni versus Shia, which is what the, you know, Western media tries to do. And if you look at USA Today, they often go on, and or you know, right-wing papers in the United States or Fox News, they often go on like that. And I think it's something which should be avoided. I'm not saying it is totally without foundation. Obviously, the United States has been backing some of the Shia religious groups against Saddam Hussein for 12 years. They've been backing the Kurds, so there is a division in the country. But the division in terms of whether there's an occupying army or foreign occupying armies or not is much less than people imagine. A number of Shia groups are calling for a boycott of the elections. In the first phase of the resistance, there were lots of Shia and Sunnis fighting together. So it is, I think, it's not accurate to totally describe the resistance according to ethnic lines. I mean, you take Baghdad, it's a city of 6 to 7 million people. Of this 6 to 7 million people, you have 2 million Kurds, you probably have, you know, 50% are Shias. It's a mixed city. So in the resistance in Baghdad is such that the United States military commanders say that the green zone, which is the most protected zone of the city, is indefensible, and have been telling foreign embassies to organize their own protection.
I want to ask you about what you know about the way that the resistance is organized. So there's definitely an element of the Sunni resistance that's coordinated by the former military leadership and political leadership of the Ba'ath Party. Can you say more about that, what that might mean for people, and also if there are other elements that you're aware of that are at play?
Well, I think basically there are two features about the armed resistance, leaving aside the Shia militias, some of which have been involved in the resistance in the past. You have the bulk of the armed resistance is being carried out by former soldiers and officers of the Iraqi army. These were not all Ba'ath supporters. They were basically the Iraqi army historically has been a focal point of Iraqi nationalism. Inside this army, you had Shias, you had Sunnis, you had Kurds who were both Shias and Sunnis. And so the Iraqi army became the embodiment of Iraqi nationalism. Now, Saddam Hussein, during his period in power, tried to put his people in power, but there was a limit to how many he could put. So the basic character of the Iraqi army was unchanged. There were large numbers of Shia soldiers in it, too. And this army, which the United States came and disbanded at a very early point after the occupation, reformed itself in a decentralized way. There is no unified national command, as far as I know. What you do have is units fighting in different regions, different towns, different villages, different military bases, who have weaponry, who are organized, and who have enough autonomous power to do what they want without consulting each other. That is both a strength of the resistance, which makes it difficult to crack it, but it could also become a weakness, in my opinion.
I remember reading an interview with Scott Ritter who was a former arms inspector for the United Nations.
Yeah.
And he talked about coming into a training session of military people. This is, you know, long before the invasion. And they were looking at maps of Baghdad, the area between the center of town and the airport. And the houses were marked as, you know, pro-nationalists or, you know, very anti-Saddam. You know what I mean? They were, like, house by house, it was described where people's political sympathies lay. And he interpreted that to mean that people were, that the military was already preparing for the inevitability of a guerrilla conflict where they would have to know in great detail where they could count on support and where they couldn't.
I think this is probably true. I think these political leadership, including Saddam Hussein, was basically out of it and very isolated. And they knew, lots of people in the military knew, that Saddam Hussein as a politician and as a political leader was incapable of mobilizing the country against the occupation, precisely because of what he himself had done in the past. And so they began, you know, according to information which has been published in the press, sections of the Iraqi army, people who regard themselves first as nationalists and secondly as in everything else or anything else, began to organize way before the occupation began. So the arms were moved, arms dumps were created in different parts of the country, and they were well prepared.
Your colleague at the New Left Review, Susan Watkins, wrote an article in the summertime comparing the Iraqi resistance to other resistances against occupation, and quite favorably she talked about the sort of strength, what the strengths are of the Iraqi insurgency. I'm wondering if you have any comments or if you could sort of sketch it out for our listeners.
Well, I think the argument being made in that text was that basically the Iraqi resistance grew before, grew at in a very short time, unlike the resistances which began in Europe during the Second World War or the post or the anti-colonial resistances in Vietnam and Algeria. That these took a long time to develop. The Iraqi resistance began very rapidly. And it was almost as everything we had seen in the past was telescoped. And I think that's the point. It's an important point to make. And what it suggests is that a great deal of planning and thought had taken place in fighting the occupying armies within Iraq, something which American policymakers totally failed to take into account. They assumed that Saddam Hussein was so unpopular that they would be greeted as liberators, whereas what they got completely wrong, they were right, Saddam Hussein is very unpopular, but being occupied by a foreign power is even more unpopular. That is something they couldn't take into account. But some of us tried to warn them, saying, look, this is going to be very different from the Balkans, where you've intervened before. You are going to meet a resistance. The Iraqis are not going to welcome you. And we were told we were being sort of utopian, this was nonsense, etc., etc. Well, they've got their answer.
I wanted to just follow up on something you said earlier before I go to my last set of questions, which are about the future. But you noted earlier on that that one target of the armed resistance and the popular resistance as well has been the multinationals and the contractors who have been taking advantage of the situation to try and reap their millions off of the backs of Iraqi people. I'm wondering if you could highlight any particular sort of targets or campaigns or attacks.
Every foreign contractor has been targeted, despite where they come from. Iraq is quite an advanced country, culturally, educationally, economically, till the sanctions began to wreck it. So people feel if it has to be rebuilt, they're perfectly capable of doing it themselves. Secondly, a great deal of concern in the country as to what's going to happen to Iraqi oil if a puppet government is installed semi-permanently. And so over the last year and a half, you've seen over 2,000 attacks over 2,000 attacks on the oil pipelines alone to try and make it difficult for oil to be pumped out and used by the occupation. So from that point of view, the resistance has been extremely sharp. And people get worked up saying, oh, but why are they targeting civilians, foreign civilians? But most of these, they've made stupid mistakes as well, but most of these civilians are working for multinational corporations, which today, in today's world of neoliberal economics and globalization, are seen as the other part of foreign occupation. One is military, the other is economic. In Iraq, they're targeting both.
Of course, NGO workers have also been targeted, and I know there's a fair amount of discussion about that, about who's responsible for those abductions and so on, for example, of Margaret Hassan. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Or? I don't have any thoughts on that. I know what everyone else knows. The kidnapping of her has been denied by every section of the resistance. There are, you know, Baghdad is a city of rumors, and there are often rumors you can hear which are published on the web that some of these events have been carried out by the puppet government themselves to try and discredit the Iraqi national resistance in the foreign press. I mean, recently two CIA agents who were investigating corruption inside the Iraqi puppet regime were captured and shot. Now, the Iraqi government website immediately went and said that this was an act carried out by Zarqawi. But there was Zarqawi always claims what he does. There was no statement from Zarqawi's group that he had done this. And the story that is now coming out is that they were bumped off, captured and bumped off by the puppet government itself because they were getting too close to corruption at the heart of this government, which themselves have set up. So it's a complete mess. And one must be very careful in evaluating information which is published in the Western media. By and large, the news now is more effectively managed than any other time over the last 100 years.
Anthony Cordesman, in his review for the Center for Strategic and International Studies, he talks quite a bit about how the insurgents, as he says, the fighters are able to communicate with each other through the media and learn which of their tactics have the most political and military impact. And he seems to be upset about that, but doesn't really know what to suggest.
How can you do anything about that? Obviously, they're perfectly well aware of that. All resistance movements have been. And they watch very closely how this is playing in the United States itself. They're very aware of what is going on in the United States, that there is an opposition to the war, and that for the first time, a majority of Americans have said the war shouldn't have taken place. So obviously, the Iraqi resistance is aware of that and plays to it to a certain extent. And in order to discredit what they are up to, the puppet government carries out its own moves and actions, also playing to the media. But of course, they get massive non-stop coverage. I've not seen a single member of the Iraqi resistance interviewed on Western television seriously and at length. Just doesn't happen. Whereas you see the puppet government people on the air non-stop. And now the Shias have become the favored Muslims of the American Empire.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about what you see happening in the future. Obviously, the situation's pretty unstable, and there could be many predictions or expectations that turn out wrong. But first, do you have any thoughts on what's likely to happen in the immediate aftermath of Sunday's so-called election?
Well, I think the big problem is that who will be the army the so-called elected government will base itself on. The only army they can base themselves on is the occupation army. And so the big danger is that what American journalists like Tommy Friedman, the New York Times, and Charles Krauthammer and the Washington Post talk about with a gleam in their eyes, that we will now have the civil war we want in Iraq. We will now see the that is their dream. But what they underestimate is that if a government, even elected on a very partial electorate, a tiny electorate in Iraq, would find it difficult to justify working with the occupation for too long, they would become discredited and their base would begin to evaporate. And they are all aware of that, so it's not going to be as easy as the United States think. I think it's not inconceivable that a new government could demand the withdrawal, a date be set for the withdrawal of all foreign troops. They've given press conferences saying they're not going to do that, but they're very contradictory people and they're divided amongst themselves. So it's up in the air. It's impossible to predict with certainty what will happen, but it's not going to be good.
And can you say anything about the sort of vision for the country or the hopes that people have, people who are participating in the armed resistance, what they're putting out even about what their idea for Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, they want a unified Iraq. That's what they want. And they are prepared for elections after foreign troops have been withdrawn. And, I mean, it's not an unfair point, which they make, that it's impossible to have an election with a country being occupied by foreign troops. The elections in Afghanistan, which were carried out recently by the United States, were a total farce. And everyone in the region knows they're a farce. It's just so that they can say to Western public opinion through the media that we now have an elected government in Afghanistan. Iraq will be slightly different. But nonetheless, I don't think that the credibility of a government elected under the aegis of the occupation will be too high.
And to people involved in the anti-war movements in the United Kingdom or North America, what do you want to say?
Well, I think that there should be a new phase now of the anti-war movement to demand an end to the occupation and the withdrawal of all troops. This has been one of the strangest anti-war movements in world history. It came out very big, unprecedentedly big, before the war, demanding that it not happen. But once the war happened and Iraq was occupied, the movement virtually disappeared. And it is time to rebuild it again. To demand an end of the foreign occupation of Iraq. I think one has to do that.